This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films. Hello, everybody. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio. This episode is sponsored by Fandor. Go to Fandor.com, check out this great independent film streaming site. With Fandor, you can have the independent film community experience. What do you go to festivals frequently? No? Well, don't feel left out. You can go to Fandor and find out what all those people that always talking about how they saw this and that at the film festival, these are where you can find the films. You don't have to try to go to some other website where they have tens of thousands of titles and try to figure out where do I begin. This is curated for you. And I'm not kidding. I am so happy that there's finally places like Fandor where you can land if you want it. And you can get a two-week trial subscription, and then I think very, very, very nominal amount you can become a subscriber, and I think you'll be very happy. They've just made a couple of announcements, Fandor. One is about this new initiative called Fix, designed to bring makers and viewers closer together. Fix enables filmmakers to showcase their remarkable work, facilitating interaction between artists and their audience. And just some of the filmmakers that they are they have involved in this new initiative is, of course, Hal Hartley, Barry Jenkins, Marie Lossier, Mark Rappaport, and Caroline Martel. I'm happy to say that I've had Hal Hartley on once, but although we have a second interview ready to go with him and Ted Hope, which should be coming up soon. Ted Hope is the CEO of Fandor and probably largely responsible for this initiative on Fandor. Anyway, visit Fandor and check it out and see what you think. If you are, again, an indie film fan, you're going to enjoy poking around and watching different films. Lots of shorts, mid-length films, as well as features. So there you go. This episode is a conversation that I had with filmmaker Tom Gilroy. Tom directed the film The Coldlands, which is now available on Fandor. And it's not a new film to me because when it came out a few months back, theatrically, I invited on Lily Taylor, the actress and one of the leads in this film, to come on and discuss the film. And so if you go back to episode number 199, you can find my conversation with Lily and our discussion about The Coldlands. Well, now I finally have on its director, Tom Gilroy, who is an interesting fellow, and it turns out he's got this really unpredictable and interesting background, and I discovered things, which is part of course, the fun of doing something like this, is that you find all these interesting connections that people have, and then you get to, you know, enjoy it. But anyway, this so what you're about to hear is my conversation with Tom Gilroy. Again, The Coldlands is currently available on Fandor, so after you listen, go check that out. If you're not currently a member, you can watch it with this free trial and then subscribe. But I just ran into Lily Taylor just days ago. I was upstate. I'm not going to say exactly where, but I was upstate New York. And I guess from our conversation, I do remember that she mentioned she lives up there. She has a house, as does Tom. It's just a coincidence. I happen to be in a town that must be right next to where she lives because she walked in to this cafe and the next thing you know, we're chatting it up, a little reunion. So anyway, when I did talk to her, you know, officially back when the movie was coming out, Tom was there, but I didn't get a chance then to talk to him. So I'm glad to finally rectify that situation. And here now, my conversation with filmmaker Tom Gilroy.
Wash your hair while you're in there, okay?
Mom.
Are you perfect?
Maybe I am.
It works and it's free.
No. Don't even think about it.
I mean, if they keep you for observation, he could come and stay with us until you're released.
We don't need any help, really.
If they think you need him, then they think they can tell you what to do. So the best thing is to not need him.
Self-sufficient.
Self-sufficient.
I was saying that before, you know, we couldn't hear each other, that I met you maybe for a second or two a few months back when you guys did some press.
Yeah, I remember.
And, okay. And I got to talk to Lily Taylor. So it's real nice to finally have this opportunity to talk to you.
Yeah, no one ever wants to talk to me when Lily's involved.
Well, I don't believe it. You're an actor too, though, right? You come from an acting background?
Yeah, I was originally trained as an actor, and I did a very little bit of modeling, and you know, when I was super young, and then actually had a theater company with Lily and a couple of other actors that went on to be kind of well known, and I just started writing all the plays, and that's how I started to write, because we knew we wanted to do work, and we didn't really have the money to, you know, license established works by, you know, people like Ionesco or Mamet or whatever at the time. And so I just started writing, and Lily was actually super supportive of the stuff I was working on. And we just, basically all of our productions were plays that I wrote.
Wow. Was this upstate New York, or were you here?
No, it was in the city. Mm-hmm. It was like in the early, I guess, late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
And we did all of my pieces. The first thing was a cycle of one acts that was 13 one acts.
Wow.
And then the last thing that we did was I did a production of Hamlet with Jared Harris as Hamlet and Lily as Ophelia and Jared's dad, Richard Harris, as the ghost. And it was pretty wild.
You wrote Hamlet. That's pretty impressive. I didn't know that.
No,
that's incredible, actually. It's a remarkable casting and just all-around situation to be involved with. Did you, like, pinch yourself?
Well, it all happened kind of oddly. I mean, Jared and I had been friends for a long time, and he was on Mad Men, yeah. They killed him off.
Yeah, right.
And he and I have been. We actually met at one of our productions, and he came to see all of my plays, and we became quite friendly. And we just kept trying to find something together. And then we decided that Hamlet was the way to go. And then I, of course, immediately wanted Lily to be Ophelia, and I had some pretty distinct ideas about how I wanted to do Hamlet. And Jared's ideas and mine really mixed well. And then I just, you know, normally, I guess Jared at the time, a lot of people would always be asking about his father, and I never did, you know, and I just said to him one day in a meeting, you know, if there was ever a time that you were going to act with your dad, it seems like Hamlet with your dad playing the ghost. I mean, it's almost too much to pass up, and, you know, I'm not pushing you for this. And so he asked Richard, and Richard said, yeah. So Richard flew over, and it was a multimedia piece, and I filmed Richard and projected him onto smoke, and Jared walked basically inside these clouds of smoke that had Richard speaking, and it was really a kind of just amazing experience, and I really loved Richard right away as a kind of uncle or fatherly type figure, and it was a very kind of close relationship. It was a very happy time.
Not long ago, I heard Jared Harris on the Marc Maron podcast talking about his relationship with his father and how, you know, of course it must have been very complicated. I mean, most father-sons are complicated regardless. I mean, you know, even when their lives aren't quite as spectacular as, you know, probably Richard Harris's world was, you know. But, and he just remarked how, of course, I mean, it's no surprise that he would be pursuing his father's, you know, recognition and his father's approval, even well into, you know, and probably went through a lot of ambivalence about whether to become an actor, given how high the bar was. I mean, my gosh.
Yeah, I mean, I think Jared originally wasn't planning on being an actor. I think he wanted to be a lawyer,
yeah.
Which you can really see in his analysis of scripts when you work with him. He's really got a lawyer's eye. And he also has a brother, Jamie, who's a wonderful actor, and another brother, Damien, who's a director. So they all went into the storytelling business. And, you know, Richard is a very fiery person, but he's also very honest and very supportive
yeah.
of people that he likes, including me, not that I'm his child. So I'm not surprised that all three brothers had the confidence to pursue that work.
Sure. And let me ask you about this period of time that you're describing. As you started off, as you said, you even did some modeling early on and then went into acting, sounds like primarily in the theater, at least initially so. And then you sort of went through this transition of being a writer and now a film director. So I guess I'm wondering, do you miss the spotlight, or maybe that sounds even a little superficial. Do you miss that part of the craft? Or maybe you still do it, I don't know, but the acting and that part of it.
Well, I still do it. I acted in about 4 movies last year.
All right, that does count.
Yeah, and, you know, I like the freedom. It's odd. The freedom that comes with deciding that you're also going to be a writer and director kind of takes the pressure off of the decision to be an actor. And in terms of, you have an outlet at all times for your creativity. And so, you know, I didn't have to micromanage an acting career to try to get this big job that would afford me the luxury to then do this smaller, more intense and more rewarding job on an independent film or whatever. Now I'm kind of just free to just pick and choose. I mean, no one's offering me Batman or anything, but I'm free to pick and choose movies and TV, mostly movies, just based on, do I like the piece? Do I like the man or woman who is directing it? And what is it saying? And it's very freeing to not have all your eggs in one basket. And I owe that decision to Ken Loach. I was working on a film with Ken Loach as an actor in Spain. I did 3 films. I worked on 3 films with him. And he was an idol of mine before I even worked with him. And during the course of shooting this movie called Land and Freedom, said, do you have any of your writing with you? You know, you're very interesting. You have a lot of information. And as it turned out, I did have some stuff with me, and I turned him on to it. And about 3 days later, he came to me and he said, what are you doing in L.A.? Why are you living there? Why are you auditioning for crappy TV shows? You should be a director. This writing is really good. You know, I would really urge you to kind of think again. And because of that, I went on and then I did Spring Forward and a bunch of other projects and a lot of writing, and Ken became a kind of crucial mentor figure in my life. And I, working on that film, I could also see how a person can make a film outside of the normal ways films are made, about, and also about themes that are outside the normal film themes that you see in America. And he was both a kind of encouragement and mentor, but also like an example of how you can do it.
Certainly. For those who don't know who Ken Loach is, he's English, correct? And he makes,
yes,
films primarily, I use that term, you know, carefully. He primarily makes films about dealing with class issues. Most of them are narrative film. I mean, they're almost entirely narrative, I think. But stories about working class British people, primarily. I know Land of Freedom is a little bit more of a period piece. I think it took place during the Franco...
Yes, Spanish Civil War.
But it was a terrific film, by the way. How did you meet up with him originally?
Well, it's a funny story. I mean, I auditioned, and my agents at the time, who shall go unnamed, called me and said, there's this guy named Ken Loach. We think he's an NYU student. He's making a movie and the pay isn't very good. Do you want to go in on it? And I held my tongue, and because I had at that point already loved his movies like Lady Bird and Raining Stones. And of course, Kes,
right,
is the To Kill a Mockingbird of English cinema. And I went in on the audition, and I don't want to name any names. I walked in and there was a room full of actors there, about 3 of them internationally famous, and it was my time to go, and they opened the door, and another internationally famous American actor walks out of the room, and I walk in, and there was no script. I knew nothing about what the movie was about, and Ken was in there with a guy who later became one of my very dear friends, this guy Paul Laverty, who went on to write about 15 films for Ken. And we just started talking, and Ken said, in your opinion, could you just tell me, what do you think is the status of the American left? And this is in 1995. And I said, do you really want me to answer that question? And he said, why? I said, well, because this is the moment where I always lose the job when we go into this kind of conversation. And he started laughing. He said, why? And then I went into my opinions as a leftist about what I thought about is the dissolution of the American left and how the culture was becoming more and more right-wing under Reagan, et cetera, et cetera. And talked to him for like half an hour, no script, nothing, and then left. And then about a month, and I thought, that's it, I screwed that up, I'm not getting that job. And then about a month later, he was back, and he called my agent, and they said, you know, will you go in? And I said, sure. And I went in, and then I had to do an improv. And the improv had nothing to do with Spain, nothing to do with the Spanish Civil War, nothing to do with the movie. And he was very polite, and I left, and I didn't hear from him. And then about 2 months later, I got a phone call, and it's him. And he's like, hi, Tom, it's Ken Loach. How are you doing? And I was like, I'm fine. You know, how are you? And he said, so look, I want you to come and do the movie with me, this little movie. And I said, what little movie? The movie that I auditioned for? And he said, yeah. Can you come to Spain in a month? And I said, sure. What's the movie about?
Right.
And he said, it's about the Spanish Civil War. And I said, oh, okay. What should I research? And he said, don't do any research after the date, whatever it was, June 6th, 1934 or something. Don't do any other research. But just look at what was going on in New York and what you would have known as a New Yorker in that time about what was going on in the world. So I go, okay. And then about a week, I don't hear from him. And then about a week before I was supposed to leave, I called him up and I said, Ken, it's Tom Gilroy. And he's like, oh, hi, how are you? And I said, look, you know, it's not a problem, but I don't have a script. No one has sent me a script and no one's been in any contact with me. You know, I'm just curious. And he says, oh, no, there is no script. You just come and you'll be improvising with all the other lads. And whatever you need to know along the way, I'll just tell you along the way. And he said, I'll call you in a couple of days and we'll just talk about your character a little bit. And then we'll be good to go.
Wow.
So that's how I embarked on this 2 month odyssey in the mountains of Spain with Ken Loach. And, you know, it being an improvisational movie, it really kind of opened up my brain in terms of the possibilities of what I could maybe do as a creative person. And then after I had this conversation with him, it really gave me the kind of guts to kind of take the next step out of theater, you know, where I had very little training and as a writer, and kind of step into film. And then I made a short with Lily Taylor, and then the whole thing started from there.
It's a great story.
Yeah, I mean, for people who are listening that don't really know Ken's work, yeah. I mean, Ken is, he made Kes, which is like this legendary British film. It's literally culturally equal to Kill a Mockingbird. He's been invited more to Cannes and won more awards than Cannes than any living director.
I forget how often they include him, and that's right. I'm a big fan of his films. But to transition clumsily to your new film, which I did see when it came out theatrically, The Cold Lands, which stars, among other actors, your friend Lily Taylor. You shot this... You shot it upstate by where, I think, in the Catskills, correct, where you both happen to have homes?
Yeah, I bought a basically a dilapidated farmhouse with my girlfriend and my brother about 40 minutes away from Lily and about 25 minutes outside of Albany. And I was basically working with a contractor, kind of, you know, bringing the house up to code. And while I was there, I began to meet all these people in this very, very small mountain town of about 300 people and started to formulate the idea for a film. And, you know, it was all coming out of the stories of the people that I was meeting and the kind of milieu of the area. And then the little boy who is the lead in the movie, Silas Yelich, he's born and raised in the town.
All right, yeah, that's true. I remember now Lily mentioning that, yeah.
And, you know, I met him. I met a couple of kids from the surrounding area, and Silas was the one that I was most interested in. And then we had an agreement I taught him acting for a year. He came to my house every 2 weeks for a couple hours, and I would teach him the basics of acting. in the middle of that year, the band REM came to me and commissioned a short film, and I spoke to Michael Stipe, and I said, I'd like to try out this little kid, who's now obviously a grown boy, if that's okay with you, and just to see, you know, if he has the chops. And Michael said, go for it. And so we shot a 12-minute film, I think it is, for REM in the snow at night. It was 15 below zero for 4 days, and the kid Silas was just great. And so we thought, okay, let's do this movie.
What was the project for, if not obviously a music video?
No, what had happened was REM knew they were making what was to be their last album. And Michael, rather than make videos, wanted to curate 11 filmmakers to make short films centered around a specific song that he would assign. And you didn't have to use any of the music. You didn't, you know, you could use 1 second of it. You could, in my case, I not only remixed it, but I created a whole new section right in the middle of it musically, and with Eddie Vedder and Joel, the guy from Hidden Cameras. And so like James Franco did one, and Jem Cohen and Jim McKay and Sam Taylor Wood, Sophie Cal from France. And it was kind of just like a curated film collection, a kind of riffing on the energy of REM. They weren't, some of them are more video-ish, quote unquote music video-ish than others, but some are just like short films that used songs as a kind of jumping off point. And it's actually what inspired me to do the little collaborative series of films centered around the Coldlands that I just finished. So it was a really creative little idea that Michael had.
Did it end up going to a festival or festivals?
Yeah, they did a special thing at South By.
Oh, they did.
And then they did a night in London at some theater where Michael flew to London, and they showed them all, and Michael was interviewed live via Skype or something on stage with a guy from The Guardian.
Yeah.
And in fact, in the interview, Michael talked a little bit about Silas and a little bit about, because people are really taken by Silas, you know, like especially Patti Smith was really just like wowed by the kid's face and his ability to project. And so there were a lot of questions about him. So Michael spoke a bit about it on the stage in London. It was really a nice little commemorative thing for Silas. I'm sure sooner or later they'll put them out. I don't know with the internet anymore if people even do that. But that was the plan.
Getting back to the Coldlands, Silas plays a young man who's very close to his mother. Maybe he feels sometimes a little like he wants more distance. And he certainly and unfortunately gets that when she passes away early in the story, and then seeks refuge in the woods, right? And then meets up with a loner or right another, and takes him sort of under his wing.
Yeah.
There's kind of a Thoreauvian theme going on here, you know, like kind of seeking the refuge in the woods and away from civilization.
Well, certainly, at the risk of sounding pretentious,
no, go ahead.
I'm the greatest filmmaker ever, you know.
yeah, right before Ken Loach.
Yeah. You know, I was aware when I was making the film that I wanted to have a story that was coming out of my experience in upstate New York, but was also channeling a kind of longer, broader flavor or series of flavors consistent with American culture. And so Thoreau was part of it. Kerouac was part of it. Obviously, the boy's name is Atticus.
Right.
And
that's obviously one of your favorite books. One of my favorite books, too, by the way.
Yeah, and it's my favorite film. And it was also influenced by the Hudson Valley painters, a little bit by Edward Hopper. There's lots of references to lots of things in American culture, and I was consciously placing the story in that continuum.
I see.
Because I wanted to consciously make a statement or an observation, at least, about American society right now, and wanted to call upon the people who came before me to kind of like hold hands to move forward. And so those references, like Thoreau, people have talked about Mark Twain and Huckleberry Finn. People have talked about Emerson. I'm certainly flattered by all of those comparisons, but more than flattered, I'm inspired that those people are still in the vernacular enough that their work is discussable and noticeable.
Oh my God, yeah. It's kind of scary just to what extent technology inserted itself, or we've allowed it to insert itself in our lives. And this movie is kind of refreshing because, or the story is refreshing because, you know, it's just so either in the background or non-existent at all. And I obviously,
yeah,
it's quite intentional on your part. And
well, I mean, there are also very obvious insertions into how it's absolutely unavoidable. I mean, you know, the Lily character has to, she works where she's plugging in her laptop and her cell phone. And after she passes away, the cell phone becomes really the only connection that the kid has anymore to his mother. And, you know, then he meets up with Carter, who is basically a homeless itinerant right out of the kind of Kerouac, Don Carpenter tradition. And the guy lives out of his car, but he has an iPhone and manages to hold down a couple of jobs and try to run a small business with an iPhone and, you know, a car. So it's not exactly Luddite
right
in its approach. I mean, I think these things are here with us forever. But, you know, I was trying to – this movie has a very kind of spiritual bent. And I think, you know, spirituality can be – especially in the case of the little boy, can be channeled through any device, whether it's, a divining stick or something, or
right,
a cell phone.
Yeah. I have a 10-year-old, and I mean, they will create whatever, you know, they're very good at filling in whatever gaps are necessary. Like if they need something for their fantasy, they'll create it out of whatever's available.
Yeah, well, so do we. We do it as adults. I mean, it never mentions the rapture in the Bible, and you have, you know, hundreds of thousands of people that think that, you know, it's just around the corner. So, I mean, everybody fills in the blanks any way that you, you know. We all have a lot of imagination. I mean, there are people that will tell you global warming's not happening. So, I mean.
Right. So when it came to, I guess, the digital distribution, or Fandor was the way you went. Did you get, like, contacted by Ted Hope? How did that choice come about?
You know, I really don't know. I mean, it just, the thing about the whole distribution of this movie, I attended something at the San Francisco Film Society, where I'm in San Francisco now, and I guess about a year ago, one festival ago, with some people from CineReach and my partner Paul Mazet, and it was all about alternative ways to get your film out there, you know, despite the collapse of theatrical and all of that. And so I participated in this thing, and Ted was the guy that was orchestrating it. And then over the course of the year, you know, in having the movie come out and kind of self-distributing more or less with CineReach, you know, we took a lot of those lessons to heart. And it's why I made the film shorts series. And I have a book coming out that's related to the Cold Lens. And so it just kind of seemed to come full circle when I was talking to Ted, and Ted was like, well, I'd love to have Fandor be involved. And I was like, well, sure. I mean, it seems like it's already... It didn't really seem to me like a decision had to be made. It seemed like it was just part of, once again, saying yes and moving
yeah.
forward and seeing where it all takes you. And so here I am now on a grant from the San Francisco Film Society writing a totally other movie. And the film's going to show here at the Roxy, a theater that I first visited 25 years ago, in 2 weeks. It's an amazing, amazing series of events.
Enjoy it. Write it out.
Oh, I am enjoying it.
I'm glad to hear it. Very good. The Cold Lens will be premiering on Fandor in August, I think is what I heard.
That sounds about right. And then there's a book coming out mm-hmm. called Somebody Else's Nowhere that is photography and haiku that I wrote and shot while making the movie. And you get the movie, you get a DVD of the movie in that book. I think that's coinciding with the release from Fandor. But yeah, and we're going to do a few more festivals. I mean, a few more local screenings. I'm taking it to Minneapolis. I think we're doing Olympia, Washington, and I think Seattle, and then Austin.
Terrific.
So,
terrific.
Yeah.
What's the website?
It's just thecoldlens.com.
That's easy to remember.
I'm more focused on getting the book together and these little shorts and getting all that out. Because otherwise I get bogged down in the details and I just stop being creative.
Understood. It's probably a good way to go.
I hope so.
I'm looking forward to checking out the book and hearing more and seeing more of your work, because I really thought that was a lovely film, The Cold Lands.
Have you ever seen Spring Forward?
No, I don't think I have, which is unusual because I do try to go and see as much as I can usually when I'm talking to folks, but I this one slipped through. Spring Forward.
Well, if you're a Ned Beatty fan, Spring Forward is incredible for him, and it's his favorite film. It's the role that he thinks he's best in. He's done his best work, and I'd recommend checking it out.
I totally will. That's right. I did make note of that. I just, as you mentioned it, I was thinking about that I needed to see it. To answer your question, yes, I am a big fan of Ned Beatty's, always have been. There's another guy.
Yeah, he's one of our true treasures.
Absolutely.
You know, it's up there with Meryl Streep, in my opinion.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, and still one of those guys who most people just know as, hey, that guy, I know him, you know, that kind of, that not a household name, but
yeah.
Everybody has seen his work, you know, he's been working probably for 5 decades, you know.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad it's worked out.
Thank you.
I'm glad we could make this happen, and I hope that we can talk again soon.
Anytime you want to talk, I'm happy to... Talking is my addiction, and that's why I had to come to San Francisco to write a movie. Otherwise, I'd be walking around my neighborhood talking to people right now.
All right, Tom. Good talking to you.
All right, Adam. Talk to you soon. Have a good one.
You too. Thank you.
See what I'm saying? Ken Loach. I mean, who would have ever thought that this guy, was in Ken Loach movies? But as it turns out, he's got this great connection with Ken Loach, and he has this amazing theater background, and he was a model. I mean, it's just kind of cool. I enjoy learning about people. Anyway, thank you, Tom, for that. And it's a great movie, and that kid he's talking about is very talented. I can attest to it. And I'm sure he'll be on this podcast one day. So the next Fandor show will likely be with Ted Hope and Hal Hartley. And that's probably coming up pretty soon. So continue to listen in for that, because to think that I would do a podcast and that Hal Hartley would not be only on once, but now a second time, is pretty amazing. And I was finally glad to bring on Ted Hope, who I wanted on way before I even have, started this relationship with Fandor. I've wanted Ted Hope on for ages. Finally, very nice to be able to check off. And of course, I'm hoping that Ted will come on and more regularly, maybe, even if it's just getting him on the phone. Anyway, thank you to Tom Gilroy. Thank you for listening, folks. This is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films, again, sponsored by Fandor. Until next time.